From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A day at the movies on this edition of Fresh Air, we get the latest opinions of one of America's leading film critics, Pauline Kael. Kael's reviews for The New Yorker often run counter to those of her colleagues. Kael doesn't mind. She says irritation is an important part of her job. Also today, Tobe Hooper looks back at his horror film that truly did horrify audiences, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Hooper also directed the first installment of the new TV series, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Also, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines how Hollywood has portrayed his profession, linguistics. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest work from screenwriter and novelist Graham Greene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. One of Pauline Kael's fellow film critics made the observation that Kael's responses to movies are sometimes more interesting than the movies themselves. For the past 20 years, Kael has written film reviews for The New Yorker magazine, and in that time, she has become arguably America's preeminent film critic. She's passionate about movies and thinks movies can overwhelm us as no other art form, yet there are periods during which she has despaired over how bad films have become. She acknowledges that the balance between art and business is always a precarious one, but she says at least in the past the movie business was in the hands of businessmen who loved movies. Now that conglomerates have taken over, that's no longer the case. Every 3 years or so, Pauline Kael's New Yorker reviews are collected in a new book. She's completing a new collection due for publication this March to be called Hooked. Today, Pauline Kael is in Philadelphia speaking to students at the University of Pennsylvania as part of their Penn at Penn program. Pauline Kael, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You haven't been in The New Yorker since late June of this year. You took a very short leave, and you're going to be back this coming week. But I want to start off by catching up on some films that your avid readers haven't had the chance to hear your opinion about yet. Are there films that you've been recommending this summer that you haven't had a chance to review yet?
Yes, The Last Temptation of Christ, for one. You know, Scorsese is a major movie maker, and there are some wonderful visual tricks and visual ideas in this movie, and there's some wonderful performances. I liked particularly Irvin Kershner as Zebedee the Cynic, and I liked Barry Miller, and Harvey Keitel's Judas was awfully good. I wasn't much struck with Willem Dafoe's Christ, but the others more than compensated for that. I found an excitement in the film simply watching a major filmmaker working. I saw so many movies that were so negligible just in visual terms. And I don't mean photographic terms, I mean in thinking visually. Whereas Scorsese really does that. And when his mind is working, you get something interesting. Also, I love the fact that what you see on the screen are Catholic schoolboys' confusions. It's almost as if everything that plagued him as an adolescent he'd put up there on the screen. And it's a remarkably honest movie. It's also a very respectful movie. I really think the fuss is unwarranted and undeserved.
Are there any movies you think you would have cast a dissenting vote about if you had reviewed them over the summer?
Oh, yes, Roger Rabbit, which I found a noisy, frenetic bore. And I was amazed that people were taking this bummer of a movie as if it were a triumph. It certainly didn't seem a triumph to me. The animation mixture with live actors didn't seem to me to be interestingly done. I've liked animation films from Europe, such as the movie by Carol Zeman called The Fabulous World of Jules Verne. It's sometimes referred to as The Deadly Invention. And in that film, you have something very interesting in the mixture of the two forms. The live action is presented two-dimensionally so that it looks like animation, and there's real wit in that. But I found in Roger Rabbit presenting the animation three-dimensionally to make it tie in with the live action wasn't witty at all. It just seemed sort of dumb, and the movie is so noisy that about half hour before the end, I felt, let me get out of here.
When you're reviewing movies, you choose the movie you're going to review or the movies you're going to review that week, and
right.
You get to think them out in great detail. When you're not actually writing a review about a movie, do you find that your thoughts are ever less clarified because you're not going through that exercise of putting it all on paper?
I think that's true. I certainly don't think it out the way I do as I'm writing, because the whole act of writing is thinking out. And that's what's fun about it, because you get new kinds of clarification and illumination while you're writing. But at the same time, you do think about movies when you see them, if you're used to thinking about them, and I am by now, God knows.
Right.
But something like, say, Married to the Mob, which I enjoyed enormously and thought, this is a terrific dating movie. We haven't had one for a while. This is the reason, you know, kids love to go to movies in earlier eras, a movie that just makes you feel good and has amusing people and isn't to be taken seriously. Something like that I might have thought out in different terms if I'd been writing about it, whereas I simply enjoyed it seeing it as a paying customer.
Film critic Pauline Kael is my guest. You once said that it's sometimes hard for you to convince friends of yours to see the movies that you thought were really good because some of them are genre films that might seem trashy.
Right. It was hard to persuade friends to go see Reanimator,
right,
for
right.
example.
You once described movies as our national theater, and I wonder if you think that that's still the case, since so many of the really good movies, like two that you described, High Tide and High Season, are small movies that very few people actually go to see. And I sometimes feel like we're not all seeing the same movies anymore.
We're not. I mean, that's one of the things I find really disturbing, that movies are breaking apart so that we have the mass audience that goes to the Eddie Murphy pictures and to the Rambo movies. And then we have the smaller audience that may hunt out the interesting movies like Roxanne or even like Moonstruck. That doesn't draw on the Rambo people, I don't think.
It was still a very big hit, though,
yes,
compared
that,
to a lot of
that
other
perhaps, films. That perhaps was a bad example. Moonstruck probably drew from both audiences. But there aren't enough pictures like that that do draw from both audiences. I doubt, for example, if Bull Durham will reach as large an audience as it might, because its appeal is perhaps a little too sophisticated. The language seems to bother a number of people who aren't bothered by raw language in big action films. Certain films that accept a sophisticated tone disturb people. I've had a lot of mail from people who are furious that I sent them to Bull Durham because the language gets to them. Well, I didn't even register the language. It just doesn't bother me. I don't hear it in those terms. And I keep forgetting that there are a lot of religious people who are disturbed by that.
Well, one movie about a year ago that you sent people to through your review was The Stepfather, which barely even played in most cities. And this was a thriller that you liked very much and that almost didn't even open, as I recall.
I know, and I got
and that
angry
seems kind of
mail
typical
on
of
that.
What's happening now.
Well, a lot of people were very disturbed by it. You know, a good thriller tends to scare people.
Uh-huh.
And if it isn't a highly publicized thriller, they get angry. If it's highly publicized, then they take that for granted. But somehow, if it's a rather obscure movie and they really get scared, they write off an angry letter to the reviewer.
On the other hand, you in your forthcoming book, Hooked, I've gotten a chance to see the galleys, and one of your chapters is headlined Sacred Monsters. And this includes the films The Color Purple, Shoah, and Out of Africa, three movies that were roundly applauded by most critics and most audiences, movies that are supposed to have a certain degree of refinement and intellectual depth. And you criticized all of them, and I think you frequently do take the air out of movies that you think have gotten,
I think,
or are going to get inflated reputations.
Yeah, there are a lot of big pompous movies that I think need the air poked out of them. I don't really know anybody who enjoyed Out of Africa. And yet people wrote me very angry letters for panning it. I think there was such a big prestige treatment for that movie that people felt they'd seen something important. I think the same thing happened with The Last Emperor. It got a lot of prestige treatment. I found it a really very unexciting movie. I mean, certainly, in many ways, one of the least exciting things that Bertolucci had ever done. It seems as if a director does really remarkable work, he gets his reward by doing something really dull and overblown and obscure, and then people feel they're seeing something.
You've said that you're puzzled by the number of people looking for importance in movies. What's wrong with it?
Well, they look for importance at the end of the year when awards are to be given out, because the movies that are fun, that have something new and innovative, are so rarely the ones that get nominated for Academy Awards or get considered important. I think the only really new film artist who's turned up in the last few years who's exciting is the Spaniard Pedro Almodovar. And since his works are really wildly funny, I don't think there's a ghost of a chance he'd be taken seriously by the Motion Picture Academy. But movies like Matador and Law of Desire and his forthcoming movie, A Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, are just hilariously original new works by a very young, gifted man who very serenely lets the wildest things happen in his movies and seems undisturbed by them, just takes them all in stride. And there's an original temperament there. That's what's lacking in American movies at the moment. We haven't really had an original temperament for a while. We haven't had an original force, I guess, since Coppola and Altman particularly, and maybe Scorsese, and before that De Palma. Those were the ones who brought something strikingly new into American movies. And now there aren't younger voices coming up that are powerful.
Well, you were mentioning Pedro Almodovar. Now, his movies are very sexual, with all kinds of sexuality of every genre.
Right.
This is the kind of movie that would be very hard to make as a mainstream movie in America, and I understand his movies are very mainstream in Spain. Do you think that the kind of business control of movies is making it difficult for the young voices to emerge?
Well, the business people are so successful at selling big movies. I mean, they're so good at putting $9 million into television campaigns and into print campaigns that people barely see the ads for Matador or Law of Desire or a picture like The Hour of the Star. They just don't hear of it. Even if they see the ad, they forget about it a minute later. Even if they read me, you know, plugging away, pleading with them to go see it, they forget that in 10 minutes because they see the huge campaign for the big pictures. And in that sense, the big pictures simply destroy the chances for the little ones.
I want to read something that you said in your review of Cocoon. You wrote, "Movies that are consciously life-affirming are to be consciously avoided. The warning signs are easy to spot in the ads for Cocoon. Look at the quotes. The big hug of the summer. Offer something for everyone who's perennially young at heart." Do people call you insensitive when you say things like that?
Oh, sure. And particularly if there's some political content in the work, then they become really angry. But there is something about conscious life affirmation. It may be applauded by the National Endowment. It may be honored at Kennedy Center. But it is a drag, and generally it's phony and as commercial as it can be. I'd much rather go see something like Beetlejuice that has some original comedy in it than something that tells me how wonderful life is and how great it is for parents and children to come together. I mean, I've been hearing that line all my life. Silent movies and 30s movies used to sell that line, and they don't sell it any better anymore.
When you say something about a movie like you did about Cocoon, about movies that are life-affirming or to be consciously avoided, consciously life-affirming, what reaction do you get from people who really felt moved by the movie? Do they feel insulted because you've criticized something that moved them?
Sure. And generally speaking, moviegoers feel that if they're moved by something, if it makes them cry or if it makes their throats clog up, that means it's a great movie and there's something the matter with you. You're some cold creature if you don't feel the same way. And if you tried to remind them there are aesthetic dimensions to movies, they're not interested in that. Every once in a while, though, there is a movie that I like that has elements that even the most educated audience also likes, a movie like A World Apart. And then I don't get hostile mail for praising it. But I'm used to getting angry mail. I mean, I got angry mail for praising Beetlejuice. I mean, you'd think that would be such an inoffensively charming oddball movie that people could accept it. But people who are educated enough to be New Yorker readers are often the stuffiest about movies. So I think I perform an important function in that I keep irritating them.
My guest is Pauline Kael, who writes film criticism for The New Yorker magazine. She's written for The New Yorker since 1968. A collection of her recent New Yorker reviews is due out in March, and it's going to be called Hooked. We'll talk more about movies after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Pauline Kael is my guest, and in keeping with what we were going to be talking about, I want to read an excerpt of another film review that you wrote. Okay. This is your review of Stand By Me. Consciously sensitive movie making is a sickly thing. Stand By Me, Rob Reiner's film, is steeped in tenderness and understanding and nostalgia. It's the sort of movie that you're likely to see described as a quiet little gem. It's ersatz art. Seeing it is like watching an extended Christmas special of The Waltons or Little House on the Prairie. It makes you feel virtuous. If there is any test that can be applied to movies, it's that the good ones never make you feel virtuous. Explain.
I think that's true. I think that if there's anything fresh or exciting or original in a movie, it stimulates you. It never makes you feel good for recognizing this wholesome sentiment. It never touches those wholesome corners of your heart. And that's the real source of kitsch movie making, is the movie that congratulates you for being you and being warm and tender and for honoring it. I mean, it sets up a terrible mutual admiration society. It's what I have against big. It makes you feel how wonderful it is to be little. And there's something kind of disgusting in that congratulatory message that film has, because it finally says to you, you're not ready to deal with the big world either. You really want to go back to your childhood, don't you? And isn't that when you were honest and wonderful and warm? I mean, it totally falsifies what your childhood really was and the miseries of adolescence. And it tries to tell you that it was the most wonderful time of your life. And somehow people get caught up in that, and they refuse to remember what their childhood really was like. They want to believe these lovely little lies that are tossed at them. I'd much rather see a cheap, corny, sleazy movie than something that has all this tenderness built into it.
Well, it's funny how sometimes the sleazy movies have great performances in them?
Sure they do. There are good people begging for jobs, and they get into funny, crummy movies. And there are funny, you know, exploitation movies like Reanimator that really have a lot of wit. That has a lot more wit than Big does. And there are movies that, like Big Business with Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin, that are really, you know, not very well done and not particularly original, but that yet have some temperament and humor. I mean, I'd much rather watch Bette Midler in that than watch Tom Hanks doing his full number in Big. I mean, good as Tom Hanks is, he doesn't really do anything very exciting, for me at least, in Big. Whereas Bette Midler just drives me out of my skull. I mean, I've never seen anybody do the things she does.
In reviewing Broadcast News about James Brooks, the director, you wrote, he can't seem to imagine having a conflicted, despairing relationship with your profession. And I was wondering if you ever felt that you had that kind of relationship with your profession, a conflicted, sometimes despairing relationship.
I think that's true. I haven't thought of it in those terms, but sure, it's true. Because sometimes You're writing, you know, so hard for yourself because you know practically nobody's going to agree with you. And sometimes you're writing about such a big turkey that you feel, why am I spending my time on this? I'm a grown-up person. I should be doing something more sensible. And, of course, you do despair when at least two-thirds of the time you're writing about movies that aren't really worth writing about, except as sanitation work. And you want people to know why you think these big movies are no good, because you feel you've got to say it. And yet you're angry that it's necessary to say it. I think if I were doing political writing, if I had to try to analyze what I felt about Quayle, I'd run into the same despairing problem.
Are there bad movie critics that you think give good movie critics a bad name? And I don't mean that you should name names here, but are there things that bad movie critics do?
Sure.
That make all movie critics look bad?
Yes, sure. Because people assume that somehow all critics are alike. They don't think all writers are alike. And critics are as different from each other as other kinds of writers are different from each other. But they assume you often get thrown at you what some other critic has done. And, of course, now the critics who are most prominent in the public eye are the ones who appear on television, the dueling critics in particular. And it is thought that all that any of us do is sit in limousines and go and say thumbs up, thumbs down, or what's the dog of the week, or, you know, it is thought it's all easy. I mean, for some of it, it's writing and writing to deadline, which is tough and rough on your system. It's also chasing around in all kinds of weather, standing in line often to get to see the movies. It's a hard job, but it's thought now to be a new glamour trade, and it's thought to be the easiest thing in the world because what a lot of them do does appear awfully easy, and I think probably is awfully easy because it doesn't take anything. They don't strain their own resources to try to analyze something. They just give a quick top-of-the-head judgment.
I know one thing that you highly value is honesty, the honesty of your response in a review. And I wonder if that honesty carries over to other parts of your life. And here's what I'm thinking. A lot of people, in a review, it's like your duty to be as honest as possible. But in real life, a lot of people would prefer that you clean up your opinion a little bit to preserve a friendship. Frequently, let's face it, we don't want to hear honesty. We want to hear something nice.
I don't offer judgments to friends or others unless they ask for it. If a young critic or a young screenwriter or a young anything asks me to read something and then wants to know what I thought, I will tell them truthfully, but I won't offer that opinion unless it's asked for. I mean, I don't go around saying, that was a real crummy job you did yesterday. I only, you know, offer it when it really is seriously asked for. And then the only toning down I might do is, you know, in order to spare the person's feelings. But I will tell them the truth. But I might not put it in as flamboyant language as I could in print.
So once people ask you for an opinion, they're going to get your real opinion.
Sure. And so far as honesty in all areas of life, who can say? I mean, you know, we all try, but my God, we've all got our blind spots. I don't really know. I think I have a rather honest temperament, but I'm sure there are areas in which, say, my daughter or my grandson would say that wasn't true.
In all your collections of books, you always thank William Shawn, who until recently was the editor of The New Yorker. You always thank him in your acknowledgments. Robert Gottlieb is the editor of The New Yorker now, and I was wondering if you feel like your writing is being directly changed at all by that change at The New Yorker. I don't know if you were directly edited by Shawn ever.
No, yes, but he did make me a handshake agreement never to change anything without discussion, and he never did. And it's one of the reasons I thank him in the new book, even though he isn't there anymore. He is the man who gave me my chance, and he is the man who stood by me. And so far as most of us are concerned, he's still the voice of The New Yorker. On the other hand, Robert Gottlieb has not made any severe changes. He has not interfered with me in any way. He's been a perfectly decent editor. But I don't feel the same commitment to him that I felt to William Shawn.
I think of you as a very influential film critic, though I notice that your reviews are seldom quoted in the big commercial ads.
That's putting it mildly.
And I think part of the reason it's like the Gene Shalits who are quoted to sell tickets.
I think I don't write in the style.
That's the other
for
reason.
For quotation.
Exactly.
And also I don't praise many films, and the films I praise are often the ones that don't have the money to take ads. There are so few big movies that I praise that I'm not really very important to the advertising agencies. On the other hand, I'm more interested in trying to get audiences for a small film like Matador or Eat the Peach than I am for, say, Midnight Run. I'm often not very interested in the big movies. I would be scandalized if I saw myself quoted for Rambo or Beverly Hills Cop 2 or something like that. I do think, you know, that you have to keep some kind of integrity. And there are, you know, the handful of films I really praise, I may be quoted, but in very tiny ads. In general, I don't write the kind of copy that says, this is sure to be an Academy Award winner come the end of the year or come March or whenever it is. I think that's a disgrace if a critic can't think of anything to say about a movie or a performance except that it should get an Academy Award nomination. There has to be something more to the art of criticism than that.
One last question about your reviewing. When you're trying to keep a record of your responses to a film, what are you keeping track of? Your response as the film unfolds while you're in the theater in the dark watching it? Or is it right after you've walked out that you're really thinking it through clearly, or a day later when you're writing the review?
I don't need to keep a record of my responses. What I do is keep a record of the continuity while I'm seeing it, because films are so complexly put together now that if I want to refer to a scene, I need to know where it comes in the movie. And so I will jot down the sequences in the continuity as I see it. I mean, I just jot that down automatically with a pencil. I don't look down at my lap. I'm watching the movie and what comes next. But I need to know so that I don't make a fool of myself by saying in the middle of the film something happens when it happens, say, at the beginning or the end. And it's often very hard to keep that continuity straight, particularly if you've got, say, 20 or 30 movies backlogged in your head before you sit down to write about them.
Your new collection of film reviews from The New Yorker is going to be called Hooked. And when I saw that title, I was wondering whether that was a play on how you're hooked on movies or how so many people in the movie industry are hooked on drugs.
No, I didn't mean it to have anything to do with drugs. I really meant it for in the sense that we're all hooked on movies, not just me. I think just about everybody I know, almost all my friends, are hooked on movies. It is simply an art that reaches us in more ways than other arts, not just because it combines them, but because it has this wonderful erotic quality. It has this sexual overtone. It is the great dating pastime. And it simply means more to us. American movies particularly mean more to us than just about any other art form.
You know, you call that a great dating pastime, but I'm sure you have to see a lot of movies alone probably at screenings. I know I've seen a lot of movies alone.
I rarely go alone.
Do you really?
Yeah, somehow I always manage to trap somebody into going with me. The only time I go alone is if I was busy writing and everybody I know already caught the movie, and then I make a quick dash for it alone. But I'd say that happens maybe one out of 20 or 30 times.
You don't like seeing movies alone?
I'd rather go with friends. It's more of a social, gregarious event. It's more fun to see a movie with other people. Also, that means you've got somebody to have dinner with. I don't want to have dinner alone.
Okay. Pauline Kael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Pauline Kael, film critic for The New Yorker magazine, and she has a new collection of reviews scheduled for publication this March. It's going to be called Hooked. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. By the way, Pauline Kael returns to The New Yorker after a short leave of absence this coming week, and one of the movies she reviews when she returns is Patty Hearst, and she tells me she really likes the score from the film. It's composed by Scott Johnson. Why don't we hear some of it?
Please.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Toby Hooper's 1974 film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was so gruesome it helped inspire a wave of splatter films. But it was so interestingly made, it ended up in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Coming up, Toby Hooper looks back on the making of the film. He also directed the first episode of the new TV series, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Members of just about every profession find something to complain about when their occupation's portrayed on the screen. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, gives his views on movies about linguists. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest work from screenwriter and novelist Graham Greene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Michael Dukakis talked tough on trade today, blasting the Reagan administration for hanging a for sale sign on America, creating an economy which makes the country a bargain for foreign investors. More from NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Sounding the themes of economic nationalism, Dukakis told the crowd at an auto parts plant in Missouri that
if we can be the strongest military power in the world, we should also be able to produce the most successful products in the world, designed by American minds, built by American hands, producing American profits and American paychecks.
Michael Dukakis did not know when he made that speech that the factory he was standing in is owned by an Italian company, Fiat. I'm Linda Wertheimer with the Dukakis campaign in Missouri.
George Bush campaigned in Ohio today, where law and order was again the theme. Mark Uricchi of member station WKSU reports.
George Bush visited Xenia and Medina, Ohio, two small towns dominated by Republicans, but within the media range of Democratic cities like Dayton, Akron, and Cleveland. The appearance in Medina looked like a school pep rally with students from all seven of the county's high schools in attendance. The vice president attacked Massachusetts Governor Mike Dukakis for a furlough program that Bush said was like a prison with revolving doors. Bush said he would be tough on crime with a common sense approach to keeping criminals off the streets.
And I want to make sure that no one makes bail, no one gets probation, no one gets parole until you pass a drug test. You don't go free until you are drug free if you're a criminal.
Bush also backed mandatory sentences with no parole for career criminals and the death penalty for cop killers. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Uricchi.
A spokesman for the Commission on Presidential Debates said today that the second debate between presidential candidates Dukakis and Bush will take place next week in Los Angeles. The spokesman said the 90-minute debate will take place in Pauley Pavilion on the campus of UCLA. The unemployment rate dropped 0.2% last month. The Labor Department reported today that joblessness in September fell to 5.4%. The unemployment data said September's improvements were slower than in earlier months and fewer than the 280,000 new non-farm jobs that economists were predicting. In Chile, opposition radio reports that 10 people were injured by army gunfire today during a rally celebrating General Augusto Pinochet's loss in Wednesday's plebiscite. Witnesses said soldiers in Santiago fired on passing marchers who had made victory signs at them. It's the second time violence has been reported since Chilean voters on Wednesday rejected Pinochet's proposal to remain in power beyond his current presidential term. A flurry of reports reminiscent of those preceding this week's release of a hostage in Lebanon appeared in several Mideast publications today. A pro-Syrian magazine in Beirut said Anglican envoy Terry Waite and two other British hostages will be released soon. The magazine report coincided with a Christian newspaper story that said Waite will be freed within 72 hours. Waite disappeared 28 months ago in Beirut while trying to secure the release of foreign hostages there. Previous similar reports have proved to be false. Another report in the weekly Israeli newspaper The Nation said the U.S. made a deal with Iran for the freedom of U.S. hostages in Lebanon. The alleged deal reportedly involved a $7 million ransom payment to Shiite Muslim kidnappers and spare parts and arms for Iran. According to the newspaper, the U.S. rejected kidnapper demands for immunity against prosecution. Foreign journalists today got their first look at a Soviet strategic missile mounted and ready for launch. A group of 40 Soviet and foreign reporters at a missile base 150 miles from Moscow viewed a nuclear-tipped SS-11 capable of hitting any city in the eastern United States. The Soviet general who led the tour said it's the nearest Soviet equivalent to the American Minuteman II. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg watches movies, he hears how Hollywood uses dialects and what dialects are supposed to say about social class and status.
Few plays have survived the transition to the screen as well as George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion did in the 1938 version starring Leslie Howard and Wendy Hiller. Maybe it's because the play is basically about the problematic relation between appearances and reality. When Higgins undertakes to change Eliza's speech, he intends to make her only a counterfeit lady.
This is almost irresistible. She's so deliciously low. So horribly dirty.
Oh, I ain't dirty. I wash my face and hands before I come out, did.
I shall make a duchess of this draggle-tailed gutter snipe.
Oh!
In 6 months, in three, if she has a good ear and a quick tongue, I'll take her anywhere and pass her off as anything.
But by the end of the movie, Eliza really has been transfigured, and Higgins himself must acknowledge the fact.
When I think of myself crawling under your feet and being trampled on and talked down, when all the time I'd only to lift my finger to be as good as you are, oh, I could just kick myself.
By George, Eliza, I said I'd make a woman of you, and I have.
It's a compelling theme for the movies, which have always trafficked in illusions. So it's no wonder that the movies have retold the Pygmalion story a number of times. I'm not thinking so much of the 1964 film My Fair Lady, which aside from its score was a stiff costume piece with none of the passion of the Leslie Howard version. But the story has been given some interesting twists in other movies that range from Bride of Frankenstein to Radio Days. One charming version of the story that's available on videocassette is Howard Hawks' 1942 film Ball of Fire, a strange crossing of Pygmalion and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Gary Cooper is cast against type as Professor Potts, a stuffy grammarian living with six old scholars in a house near Columbia University.
It's a crime to carelessly expose this good carpet.
You've just committed a more serious crime, Miss Bragg. You have split an infinitive.
In the course of writing an article on slang, Cooper runs into Barbara Stanwyck, who plays a nightclub singer named Sugarpuss O'Shea, and he tries to interest her in his project.
See, I'm conducting an investigation on current slang. Would you object if I used you for observation and study?
Yeah, I would.
Well, if I could have your assistance for just a few days, it would be...
Out, Professor.
Then you won't help me?
No, out. Shove in your clutch.
Shove in your clutch. Exactly the kind of thing I want. Perhaps if I could come back here again when you have more time.
Save the guess. I won't be here after tonight.
Well, look, here's the address of the foundation. If you should happen to change your mind by any chance, it's my residence as well.
Listen, not now.
Well, I'll just leave it here.
Okay, Scrouse, Graham, Scraw.
The complete conjugation. All right, I'll scrawl.
But when the DA's office comes looking for Stanwyck to make her testify against her gangster boyfriend Dana Andrews, Stanwyck takes Cooper up on his offer. She moves into the house, and Cooper proceeds with his investigations.
There's another word I'd like to take up now. It's recurred several times in our discussions, and its meaning still eludes me. I think it was Miss O'Shea who used it yesterday in reference to the cuffs that I wear. The word is corny.
Yeah, wouldn't you say they were corny?
Because of the cornstarch in them?
Because it's 1941.
Cooper falls for Stanwyck, and when he learns that she's just been using him to hide out from the law, the two have a confrontation very like Higgins and Eliza's. But in this case, it's not the flower girl whose language is transformed, but the professor's.
You've given us all a fine course in the theory and practice of being a sucker. It was a very small tuition fee. Perhaps it wasn't quite worthy of you choosing us as subjects of your demonstration. Eight pushovers, like shooting fish in a barrel.
I didn't want you to get it this way. Not right in the face.
Of course, it all ends happily with Cooper beating up Dana Andrews and carrying Stanwyck away. It's a perfect American reversal of Shaw's story. If learning proper English makes Eliza into a lady, learning slang makes Professor Potts into a man. But the casting gives the movie another significance. You can see it as Hawke's parable of the history of talking pictures in the 30s, the period when they abandoned mannered theatricality for the more naturalistic voices of actors like Cooper, Cagney, and Edward G. Robinson. It's not surprising that the Pygmalion story should pop up again in the ultimate movie about movies, Stanley Donen's 1952 Singing in the Rain. Gene Kelly and Gene Hagen play silent film stars who must make the transition to talkies. Hagen has a shrill, obnoxious voice that no number of diction lessons can alter.
Now, ta te ti to tu.
Ta te ti to tu.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
Can't.
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 The solution is found in a kind of Henry Higgins ex machina. Debbie Reynolds will dub Higgins' voice for her.
All set in there?
Right.
Nothing can keep us apart. Our love will last till the stars turn cold.
All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Nothing can keep us apart. Our love will last till the stars turn cold.
That's great. Perfect. Cut.
The picture's a success, but Hagen is undone when she's asked to sing a song at the premiere. Kelly opens the curtain, and the audience sees that it's really Reynolds who is singing while Hagen mouths the words. Hagen is humiliated, and Reynolds becomes a star. On the face of things, the lesson is that artifice will be revealed, that Eliza will be unmasked at the ball when she trips on her H's. But the great in-joke of Singing in the Rain was that it was really Hagen who dubbed Reynolds singing in the movie and not the other way around. Hagen was the Duchess, and Reynolds was the flower girl, and we were all taken in. I can't imagine Shaw having written Singing in the Rain, but I think he would have taken an enormous pleasure in having produced it.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. From the soundtrack of Singing in the Rain, here's Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
But Moses, he noses, his toes aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
A mose is a mose.
A rose is a rose.
A toes is a toes. Hoop-de-doody-doodle, Moses.
This is Fresh Air. Toby Hooper's 1974 film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was so gruesome it helped inspire a wave of splatter films, but it was so interestingly made that it was added to the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Now it's a hot item at neighborhood video stores. The movie is about a group of hippies who meet up with a family of homicidal maniacs who kill strangers to the area, eat their flesh, and turn what's left over into sausage. Hooper also directed Poltergeist, the remake of Invaders from Mars, and Salem's Lot for TV. Horror film director Wes Craven says Chainsaw is one of his favorite horror films. Hooper directed the first episode of the new TV series based on Craven's film Nightmare on Elm Street. So we took this opportunity to look back with Toby Hooper on his film that changed the horror genre. Before Chainsaw, horror usually meant the supernatural, zombies, monsters, and other creatures. But in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it was people who ate flesh and played out our worst nightmares.
I don't think I set out to change the genre consciously. I was a movie fan. You know, I was a horror film buff, and I simply made a film that I wanted to see because I felt it at that time, and we're talking about something like close to 15 years ago, the horror films that that we were getting had gotten, you know, very boring and totally unscary and hokey and bad. And I wanted to make something that that worked again, that had chair jumpers in it, you know, that moved an audience. So I really set out as a fan of the genre to do something that gave you your money's worth.
Your movie is very threatening. It's very ugly. It's very hard to sit through in some ways, but it's really not that explicitly gory. It's not as gory as you'd expect it to be.
Yeah.
Was that intentional on your part, or have standards just changed since 1973?
No. That was intentional, It also had to do with my awareness of getting a rating on the picture, and I actually set out to get a PG rating.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. In fact, when I was shooting the picture, I called the MPAA and told them what I was doing, and I said, "How can I make this PG? I know the concept is rough, but." Let's hypothetically talk about a sequence. That I have a sequence, for instance, where a girl is a big guy hangs a girl up on a meat hook, and if you don't see penetration and you see the girl hanging on the meat hook, and you've suggested penetration in a kind of Hitchcock way. What will I get? Does that get an R? Does that get an X? Or how about PG? And so over the phone, talking the MPAA all the way through while shooting, I was trying to do what they suggested so I could have a PG rating. Well, when the film was finished and they saw it, it was really amazing when they have these little clipboards, you know, with lights on them in the dark room. And every few seconds, those lights would pop on, and they were making notes. And I thought, oh, that's trouble. That means they're talking about cuts. Ended up not having to make any cuts, of course, we took the R rating. And I don't know, however, had I not sincerely tried to go for a PG, the picture may have been an X.
Did anybody in the movie industry think that you were insane or dangerous after seeing the movie?
Well, you know, it's the first time I've been asked that question, I didn't get the kind of response then that say a young film director would get now making a genre piece and showing, you know, making such an impressive showing, they would instantly be embraced because of the numbers, you know, because of the scoreboard. I mean, a hit is something that makes money. And I've seen lots of young film directors embraced for making terrible movies that made, made a lot of money. But I don't know. You know, I do think some people. There were legends going around about me that I rode a Harley hog with a skull and crossbones. I don't know about whether or not I was a madman, probably so. But the film, I mean, it was very strange because as soon as it was released, it did get mixed critical acclaim, but the positive acclaim was very positive and on a big scale. It, for instance, the film that year was an official film in the at the Cannes Film Festival for the Director's Fortnight. It's a branch of the Cannes Film Festival that spotlights up-and-coming directors. And also, Chainsaw was put in permanent film archives of the Museum of Modern Art. It won awards all over the world and opened a few doors, but I think it took 7 or 8 years before mainstream filmmakers, producers, I should say, the heads of studios, before they were for some reason able to recognize this as an artistic piece of work and a very good technical piece of directing, because of what it was and because of the effect it had on you.
And now, what direction is your career heading in?
Oh well, right now it's the way I feel it should have been 10 years ago. I have more than I can do.
I like to watch the credits of old movies, of movies from 10, 15 years ago, not that old, and see who's made it big since then. And watching the close credits of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I noticed who the narrator was. So I'm gonna see if our audience can guess who it is. I'm just going to play a few seconds of this.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of 5 youths, in particular, Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother, Franklin. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day.
I don't know if our audience has guessed or not, but that's John Larroquette from Night Court fame. So how did you get him to do this movie? Did you know him? Were you friends with him? Or was he just cast?
Yeah, John was, at that time a struggling actor. I guess I'd call him a struggling actor. He was, certainly before he had, he could work every day in this business. And he was just a friend of mine. And he did an Orson Welles imitation for me one day. And I said, that's what this thing needs. It needs that Orson Welles sound in the beginning. Prologue.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Film director Toby Hooper looking back on his film The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Hooper directed the first episode of the new TV version of A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Springwood's nightmares are just beginning.
This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's new on the campaign?
Well, we'll hear from Linda Wertheimer about the Democrats' response to the Quayle Benson debate. You know, they came out with a new run of television commercials, which mm-hmm. hammer away at Dan Quayle as if he's the great weakness on the Republican ticket, following what most people saw as a Benson victory in the TV debate. Also, we hear from Vice President George Bush in his interview with our reporter Jim Engel, who's been following the Bush campaign. We cover today the new 1989 model cars, specifically the Cadillacs. They are 8 inches longer in 89 than they were in 88. The luxury is back, they tell us.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. To call Graham Greene's output prodigious would be something of an understatement. Since his early days as a film critic in the 30s, Greene's written 4 screenplays, 24 novels, 4 collections of essays, not to mention kids' books, travel books, 2 biographies, and 2 autobiographies. Book critic John Leonard has just read Graham Greene's latest work, The Captain and the Enemy.
Graham Greene's latest is less a novel than a half dozen ideas for novels, almost as many unfinished characters, and many more grace notes, moody ghosts in fitful search for meaning, for an organizing principle. There is the novel idea of Vincent, his childhood in England as an outcast, and his inability to care about anyone, especially his father. There is the novel idea of a love affair, by airmail, between the captain, a thief on several continents, and Liza, who never leaves her house. And a novel idea of the captain somehow, suddenly, in Central America, working for left-wing revolutionaries. There's also the novel idea of Quigley, an American intelligence agent pretending in Panama to be a newspaper reporter. And finally, there's the novel idea of the writer as a young man, a cannibal of his own experience, feeding on all who touch him. None of these novels has been written by Graham Greene. Aspects of them come to us in separate parts in the same parcel, like a Taiwanese do-it-yourself kit. We can put them together ourselves if we want a good book, out of our memories of other novels by Greene, like The Quiet American, Our Man in Havana, and The Comedians, with some help from his memoir, A Sort of Life, and from his peculiar account, called Getting to Know the General, of his drinking buddy relationship with Omar Torrijos, the late dictator of Panama, the one before Noriega. In other words, Greene, for whom a Nobel Prize is long past due, has trained us to do his work for him. We know from a lifetime of reading him that all children are spies, all families are conspiracies, renunciation is a kind of love, Americans abroad are wicked, and novelists are full of envy and resentment. We can be counted on to imagine a captain and a Quigley more interesting than he bothers to make them here. A better Liza with dimensions of being instead of ingredients of character half-baked. Another Vincent, whose passionate neediness and sense of abandonment have bloodlines connecting him to conscience and pity. We know from his other recent winter novels, Monsignor Quixote and Dr. Fisher of Geneva, that Greene's not always so weary, so burnt out. We might even add some God to this notebook looking for a novel, because God's otherwise entirely missing from the captain and the enemy, as if Greene had given up on him, as if he'd called off their unrequited love affair. We have the right to refuse to believe in an absence of God from Graham Greene. God's only hiding, if not in ambush, then because he's scared of the novelist. There's a wonderful passage in his best-known book, The Power and the Glory, where the whiskey priest looks into the hard old raisin eyes of a peasant woman who has just insisted on her love of God. How do you know, the priest asks her. Loving God isn't any different from loving a man or a child. It's wanting to be with him, to be near him. It's wanting to protect him from yourself. Well, that's the Graham Greene I love, and I wish I could protect him from my disappointment and from himself.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Captain and the Enemy by Graham Greene. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I speak with playwright Howard Korter about his latest project, Lip Service. It's a satire about morning TV talk show personalities, and it was co-produced by David Mamet for HBO. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from composer John Carter, and television critic David Bianculli celebrates the 20th anniversary of 60 Minutes. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Georgina Sanger. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.